Hi, volleyball fans, and welcome back to Volley Talk, the podcast created for volleyball lovers who want to dig deep into what is going on in NCAA and international volleyball. I'm your host, Sarah Pavin. I'm an Olympian, beach volleyball world champion, former Nebraska Cornhusker, and longtime pro, both indoor and on the beach.
And I'm Adam Schultz, former indoor player, international volleyball coach, and resident stats guy.
You changed the intro.
I wasn't really comfortable calling myself a guru, so we're going to change it up.
I wrote that intro, so I called you that, but fair. You can do whatever you want. Okay, you guys, the pressure is mounting as we start seeing conference champions being named, and Selection Sunday is coming up very soon.
This is my favorite time of year. I love to see which teams step up, which ones can't handle the pressure, and who's ready for tournament time.
We have already seen several conference champions be named, but there are still a lot of titles up for grabs, including in the ACC, the SEC, and the Big Ten. We saw some big upsets this week. We got to watch some highly anticipated matches, including the classic Nebraska-Wisconsin showdown. We're going to take a look at that match a little later on, but we have got a lot to discuss this week, so let's get started.
We had some teams in the Big Ten have really important weeks. So both Purdue and Wisconsin split matches this weekend. Wisconsin beat Minnesota 3-2, and that was honestly a much closer game than I thought it was going to be. My prediction was Wisconsin in three, but Minnesota really pushed them, having a better hitting percentage, and really applied pressure and blocked well against them. We also saw Wisconsin lose to Nebraska, which we will talk about later in the show.
Very interesting matches across the board for Wisconsin this week. I've been hating on Minnesota in recent weeks, and they were like, hey, here we are. Let's just take Wisconsin to five.
I feel like Minnesota is a Jekyll and Hyde team. They have the potential to be incredibly good. They're very good at the block. They can put pressure on teams from the service line, but they don't pass particularly well, and their defensive structure seems non-existent at times. So if they can put those two pieces together, they're going to cause some trouble in the tournament, but we haven't seen it yet.
They actually had a couple swings for the match.
Correct.
How did they not finish it? Like, I'm not going to get into it, but they did have a couple swings for a match. Purdue also split this week, as Adam mentioned. They lost 3-0 to Penn State in State College, but then they turned around and beat USC 3-0. So both of those teams had a tough week this week. Both of the teams split. We are going to dive into Wisconsin-Nebraska a little bit later. But another result from the Big 12 saw BYU getting upset by Cincinnati 3-2. At the time of that match, BYU was ranked number 24. I feel like that could definitely knock them out of the top 25 this week and potentially cause them issues heading into tournament time, but who knows?
We saw Claire Little and Ellie Mortensen have tough outings. Claire Little hit 172 and Ellie hit 059, and Cincinnati outdug them 74-56, so it wasn't a good night for the hitters from BYU.
Claire Little did miss last week in that trouncing BYU took from Utah. Looks like she's back. Looks like she's getting a lot of sets again, but not the most efficient night.
We're going to talk about Georgia Tech this week, and they had a tough go. They lost two matches in five to lower-ranked teams, number 23 Florida State, and then unranked Miami, and this puts them in a really tough place leading into the conference championships. We'll get into that one in detail. Those were interesting matches. We also had Missouri, my dark horse team, lose to Mississippi State 3-1, which is jamming me up right now. So they're out of the running for the SEC title with that loss, but I still think they can do damage in the tournament.
We were talking up Missouri so much last week. You were like, they're going to go so far in the tournament, and they're like, thank you so much for the compliment. Let's lose to Mississippi State. Goodbye.
You know what? This is their one loss that's going to flip the switch for them, and they're going to be ready to play come tournament time. I'm still choosing them.
That loss was a real head scratcher. And speaking of head scratchers, ladies and gentlemen, number 18 Dayton got swept by Loyola Chicago in the championship match for the Atlantic 10 title. Okay, Dayton had lost one match the entire season. They lost to Marquette early during preseason. They have rolled through the Atlantic 10 conference this year like nobody's business, okay? And they played Loyola Chicago twice, swept them both times. Things were looking good. Things were looking bright for Dayton. But Loyola Chicago said, not today. Thank you so much for holding this conference together single-handedly all season, but we will take the title. That was wild.
This is a prime example of why I love this time of year. You're poised, you're ready to go, and you're looking ahead to the tournament, and you didn't take care of business. It's just so fascinating to watch teams.
Needless to say, this week was intense. It was crazy. A lot of ups, a lot of downs, but we were here for it. We watched a ton of volleyball. We watched actually the majority of the matches we just mentioned. Yeah, just when we think that things are not going to be crazy, the NCAA surprises us.
Well, as everybody probably knows, Selection Sunday is coming up December 1st. I wouldn't say I'm new to NCAA volleyball, but I'm diving into it for the first time in depth. And I had some questions, which I'm assuming other people had as well. So we're going to go over how the bracket actually works, where the teams are coming from, and give you a little background. So the tournament is a 64-team bracket. You have 32 automatic qualifications from conference winners. I didn't realize there were 32 conferences, so that was news to me. And then you have 32 at-large bids, which are selected.
Usually done by ranking, RPI, that sort of thing. Basically, how they try to organize it. We've touched on it briefly in recent weeks. The NCAA likes to set up the bracket in such a way that as many conferences as possible will be represented at the end. So even if all season long the ABCA ranking, which is what you typically see every Monday, is a certain way, you will see adjustments to that in the tournament bracket ranking because they're looking for certain matchups to get conferences represented as equally as possible. And in the first and second weekend for round one and two, they like to keep travel to a minimum. So even if matchups might not make complete sense, geographically, they'll make it as easy as possible for travel, particularly for the smaller conferences whose budgets maybe aren't as big to be able to travel across the country and things like that. So week one is typically more regional. Obviously, there are exceptions. And then as you get into week two, which are the regional championships, that's when we see more of a mix-up. As of this recording, the following schools have earned automatic berths by winning their conference championships. We've got New Hampshire, Florida Gulf Coast, Western Kentucky, Wichita State, Loyola Chicago, Cleveland State, Fairfield, Colgate, Charleston, Yale, Chicago State, UT Arlington, and Arizona State.
One of the other interesting things is that not all championships are decided the same way. Some of the conferences take into effect the whole record over all of conference play, and other conferences have a tournament at the end of conference play, and the winner gets to go on. So it depends which conferences you're following as to which teams get to come out of that conference specifically.
So that's what happened to Dayton. If the Atlantic 10 operated in the same way that the Big 10 did, for example, Dayton would have won. They went undefeated. They had the best record. They would have won. But the Atlantic 10 does do a tournament playoff among the top seeds, and that's how that happened for them. Whereas, like, in the Big 10, whoever has the best record just wins.
Speaking of teams that have clinched their conference, ASU has earned at least a share of the Big 12 title. So they're battling with Kansas as well. If ASU loses their final game and Kansas wins, they will both be tied, meaning they will share that conference title as there is no competition for that. We also have the Big 10 title coming down to Nebraska and Penn State. this coming week, and that will be a game everybody needs to watch.
Nebraska hasn't lost in Big Ten play. They're undefeated. Penn State has lost one match. Obviously, they have other matches. We're assuming they will win those, but anything can happen. But if Penn State should beat Nebraska, then both will be tied.
What's your prediction for that match?
I think Nebraska's going to win three straight.
I'm going to go Nebraska in four.
And then we get to the ACC. Nothing is certain in the ACC.
This is the conference that I'm going to be paying attention to this week for sure.
So, coming into this final week of conference play, Pitt and Louisville are both 17-1. Stanford and SMU are both 15-3.
Pitt has Georgia Tech and Louisville. Stanford also has Georgia Tech and Louisville. And SMU has Florida State and NC State.
So, if we're playing probabilities here, SMU is probably going to win out, so they'll end with three losses. Louisville is playing Pitt and Stanford. That is tricky.
That's must-see TV.
Pitt has Georgia Tech and Louisville. Who knows what's going to happen? And then Stanford has, like, I don't know what's going to happen here.
So the ACC is really going to come down to who can play the best this weekend and who takes care of the matches that they should take care of.
After seeing Georgia Tech this week, I'm pretty confident that both Pitt and Stanford will beat them. But then I feel like it's up in the air for both of those teams against Louisville. People are going to have to show up. This is going to be, get your popcorn out, everybody, because this is going to be crazy.
There should be some great volleyball with some really high-level teams this coming week in the ACC.
We are for sure going to be tuning in to Selection Sunday on December 1st. We want to see how things are laid out. We want to create our own bracket to see how closely we can get to perfect. I don't think it'll be close.
Well, I'm really excited because I've watched a lot of these teams pretty in depth over the last month and a half that we've been doing this. And I'm probably overconfident, but I'm really looking forward to it.
Let's talk about Georgia Tech. As we mentioned earlier, they had a pretty rough week this week, dropping two matches in five sets to both Florida State and Miami. It was a bad trip to Florida on the volleyball court, that is for sure.
Not only did they lose two matches, but they really created some uncertainty in their standings moving into the tournament.
Yes. At this time, Georgia Tech, Florida State, and North Carolina are all 12-6 in the ACC.
Thinking about that, Georgia Tech could potentially have been 14-4 and locked up a spot.
That is correct, and it's absolutely wild because they, as we just said in our last segment, play Pitt and Stanford this week. So I'm just going to throw this out there. Obviously, I'm shocked every week at these results, but I'm going to say they're probably going 0-2. This week against those teams, which will put them at 12-8 to finish ACC play.
And I'm not sure that's good enough to make the tournament, depending on what happens with the other teams, because there are five teams jockeying for that position right below the top four we spoke about earlier.
Well, and not to mention, Miami and Virginia are 11-7. We talked about all the top teams and how they're playing each other this upcoming week. So the Florida State, obviously Florida State has SMU, but Florida State, UNC, Virginia, Miami, they're not playing the top teams. So their records will likely improve, meaning Georgia Tech could maybe go from fifth in the ACC to what, 10th?
Correct.
What a terrible way to end your conference play.
And we watched both of those matches, and I've got some things to say.
Let's hear it.
First of all, I think a lot of what happened this week, now it's always on the players to perform, but I was unimpressed with the coaching staff for Georgia Tech. I think your team takes on the identity of the coaching staff and the attitude that you present, and they were all over the map. In that first match against Florida State, you saw the coaches walk off and basically clapped their clipboards at the refs after losing their minds in the fifth set. They got a yellow card, and you could see the team tighten up, start complaining in the fifth set, looking at the refs. You have to remember, these is not professional sports. These are young athletes, and there's emotion involved. Some of them are freshmen. This is their first time through. You look to your coach in big moments, and I thought the Georgia Tech coaching staff let their team down.
Obviously, in every match, there is the potential for some questionable calls. Things might not always go your team's way, but the way that these coaches were treating the referees, the way that they were talking, their body language, it was awful. And I will say, even as a professional, I have played for very volatile coaches. Even with a ton of experience and self-confidence and things like that, seeing a coach act up like that on the side of the court is very distracting.
Georgia Tech should not have lost both of those matches, in my opinion.
They should not have lost. Against Florida State, they were up 15-8, which became 18-12 in the fourth set. And they were winning 2-1. They lost. And honestly, it happened after the coach had a meltdown.
Correct.
And then they were winning 2-0 against Miami and got reverse swept.
And again, as an athlete, you have to play. And we'll get into some of the performances and numbers. But watching that match, I thought the coaching staff had a direct impact on the mood, the feeling, and the confidence of the team on the floor in a negative way.
As far as the on-court stuff goes, I think that within those four lines, I wasn't seeing anybody from Georgia Tech's team bringing energy, leading the team. I saw a lot of looking to the sidelines. There was nobody on the court that was kind of directing things.
I would agree with that, and I think that was both emotionally, mentally, but also technically or performance-wise. They don't have a standout hitter, in my opinion. They don't have somebody who is a go-to player that can just score for them. And the other thing that I noticed was they don't run their middles. They rely heavily on their outside hitters. Now, they run a 6-2, so they always have a front row opposite. They played okay. But if you look at the stats against Florida, they only ran their middle 19% of the time. They hit 371, which isn't bad but isn't great for middles. And against Miami, they only ran the middle 15% of the time, and they were ineffective, hitting 136 as a pair. So as those five-set matches go on, and we've talked about this, if you're not running your middle and they don't have a consistent back row ball, you have the blockers putting up solid double blocks. The defense has a chance to get a read on those hitters, and you just make life difficult for your pin hitters if you can't run the middle.
I feel like we say this about everybody. It seems to be a common thing. When teams are not successful, they're not running their middles. We love middles. Run the middle. I know you have to pass the ball to be able to do that, but I wouldn't say that Georgia Tech's passing was that big of a liability, I didn't think.
No, I thought they had the opportunity to run it. And again, running the middle is a little more of a high-risk set if the pass isn't perfect, but it pays dividends. And we're just not seeing that. And it could be, obviously, when you're running a 6-2, you don't have a setter who can dump. But if you have a setter who's front row, they need to dump. You need to run a back row ball. You need to establish the middle of the court. And I think that was lacking in both of their losses.
I feel like they were undersetting their middles a lot, too. They were pretty low. And again, as much as we love middles, I think we've expressed our disdain for 6-2 offenses. It is so hard. A connection between a middle and their setter is so important, and it requires so much attention and training. When you're running a 6-2, you're spending two rotations with one setter and one with another as a middle. And you could definitely see the disconnect there as they were switching.
Georgia Tech's numbers against Florida overall, the game was pretty consistent for the different skills, but they edged Florida in a few different categories, outdigging them 86-76. They had similar number of blocks. They had similar number of service aces and errors. So this was a very tight match. We're talking about they traded first and second set kickings at 13 and 15, but then it was 25-21, 26-24, 15-10. They just needed someone to step up and make a play, and it didn't happen.
I personally did not think they were a very good blocking team. The number of balls that the block was there, it was set, it was composed, that ended up going between the blockers and the net, it was frequent.
It's really interesting that you bring that up. I will say that I was focused on the sidelines for a lot of that match, given what was going on, and you could see the coach putting her hands straight up and down and then pushing over the net. And I don't know whether she was trying to get her athletes to press earlier, but almost all of their athletes go straight up and then try and time the block versus putting their hands over the net as they start to create space. And I saw the same thing.
Do you think she was telling them that you're going up and then over and that's the problem? Or do you think she was telling them to do that?
I can't say because there's no audio, but I saw her making the motion of exactly what they were doing wrong. So I was curious thinking about that watching the match.
You do not want to put your hands up and then over so that you're like waving your arms almost. You almost want to think about extending your elbows straight as soon as possible to cover that distance. I hope she wasn't telling them to go up and then over.
It's what they were doing.
Yikes.
If you do look at the total blocks, Georgia Tech had 6 to Florida's 8. And against Miami, they were 10 to 13. But I think the bigger issue isn't total blocks, but as soon as the ball hits your hands and comes down in front of you, you have no chance to play defense either. The rally ends there. And so you're taking away a defensive opportunity if you're not sealing the net. The other thing that I couldn't tell was I couldn't pick up on a strategy that Georgia Tech was trying to implement. I didn't pick up a serving strategy. I couldn't figure out if they were trying to overload or attack a certain player. It just looked like they were on the court playing. I don't know if you had that same sense, but it looked the same in both matches I watched.
Yeah, I kind of felt like they were just playing their game and then reacting.
I think that's a good way to put it. Reacting to what was happening instead of imposing their game plan on the other team.
But it was also so confusing because their position 6 defender kept coming up almost in line with the libero and the back row setter on defense. And the number of balls I saw land behind her was staggering. As position 6, in my opinion, if somebody is going to hit the ball straight down, i.e. where these defenders were playing, that's on the block. Or it's on the serve. Free ball, too many options available. As a position 6 defender, I think the job is to get the touches off the block, to get the balls that are being driven deep around the block. I think being that shallow, you're doing absolutely nothing. And as I saw attack after attack get like sometimes a decent touch and go high out the back line or be hit with force behind these players, I was like, why are they positioned there?
Do you think that was undisciplined play, game plan, or trying to compensate for the poor block we spoke about earlier?
Well, I saw it in both matches that we watched. So it might just be their tendency and how they play defense, but I can't, as a coach, I don't understand how you don't correct that. So if it's not being corrected, that leads me to believe that that is what the coaching staff wants from their position 6 defender, or it was a game plan, but I can't see them having the same game plan against both teams because that is a very strange position.
I would agree with that.
Overall, for a number 15 ranked team, I was underwhelmed and quite frankly unimpressed.
I would agree. I think the number 15 ranking is probably a little high. They're consistent with their hitters, but there were nothing spectacular, and I'm assuming they're going to drop, given that I believe they'll lose their last 4 matches before the tournament starts.
again, I've been pretty critical of Minnesota and their ranking. Georgia Tech is currently ranked higher than Minnesota, but I think the team that we saw play this weekend in Georgia Tech would not stand up against Minnesota right now.
Agreed. Now the time that everybody has been looking forward to, and I'm just going to say, I called it, Nebraska 3-0 against Wisconsin. But let's get into it. Let me hear your thoughts, and I know you have a lot to say.
I am going to start this segment out with like an apology, pre-warning, buckle up, ladies and gentlemen, because it's about to be a bumpy ride. And I was watching this match and I was so frustrated. I have got a lot of thoughts. You might not like all my thoughts. You might not agree with all my thoughts. So that is why I'm giving you this pre-warning slash apology.
Okay, let me start. I'll tell you a few things that I think, and then you can finish okay. with your thoughts. Nebraska's just a better team than Wisconsin, flat out. What I like about them as a team is, A, they have a balanced offense. They don't rely on one person. They're able to do that because they pass so well. They put Wisconsin in trouble from the baseline, and this to me is the most evident. They had a game plan. They executed that game plan flawlessly, and it was incredibly effective. I said this about Georgia Tech, and I will say it about Wisconsin. I had no idea what Wisconsin was trying to do, but it was clearly evident what Nebraska came to do against Wisconsin, and they executed. They went after the young libero. Once she passed a couple good balls, or they got off of her, they served the front court left side. Then they jammed up the middle. From the service line, I thought they were brilliant. They never let Wisconsin get into any kind of rhythm.
Let me clear my throat. Here we go. Are you shocked that I agree with everything you said?
No, I mean, anybody who was watching who has played volleyball at a high level, I think would be able to see the same thing.
I thought Wisconsin was worse this outing against Nebraska than they were a couple weeks ago. The last time these two teams played, I understood and could pick up immediately what each team was trying to do. I also could pick up what Nebraska was trying to do this time around. I had no clue what Wisconsin's plan was. Absolutely none. They started out serving zone one, which they did last time, fair, which we spoke about. They serve zone one because they're so preoccupied with Andy Jackson, they don't want her to get set and make Berg and Riley spin around. Fair. But as the match progressed, and don't get me wrong, Andy Jackson did not have a good offensive match. What were her numbers?
She hit 0-67, 15 swings, 7 kills, 6 errors. So if their game plan was to neutralize her, you succeeded at that piece.
That might be the only piece. Because as the game progressed, the serves started going to zone 6. And Lexi Rodriguez was passing in zone 6. So not only are you serving an incredible serve receiver, she's right in front of Berg and Riley. Perfect view. So the setter can keep an eye on every single attack option and see where the pass is coming. Piece of cake, volleyball basics.
And not only were they serving her, they were serving her in the middle third of the court. She didn't have to move short. She didn't have to open up and push the ball to the net. She literally could have eaten an ice cream cone and passed those balls.
I will say Charlie Furbringer had a couple cross-court serves to the zone one sideline that were very effective. She got a couple aces that way, but that was the exception. Okay, since we're on serving.
Oh boy.
Not only do you have your DS that is missing a ton of serves, your current libero, Sage Damro, is missing a ton of serves. She is playing good defense. I will give her that. I do think that she is playing well defensively, but passing is an issue.
Sarah Franklin is passing 3/4 of the court.
When your go-to hitter is diving on the ground to make your libero not have to pass, that's a head scratcher. And then on top of that, you're bringing in yet another DS who is hidden in serve receive. They do not let this girl even pass. And then she's not really digging anything either. So my question is, you're telling me that you just do what you do. This is what we do. This is how we're going to operate. I'm going to make these subs, even if they make no sense. These subs make no sense. Your serving sub, missing serves. Your defensive specialist isn't digging balls. and she's not passing, and your libero, your main attacker is taking balls, poaching balls from her to please don't serve her again. Why do you continue to do this? Like, let's be flexible, let's be adaptable. You're trying to tell me there is not one person on your entire bench, even a potential left side, that could go in and serve a ball in, that could go in and maybe make a dig. I'm clearly passionate. I think you can hear it in my voice. Like, this makes absolutely no sense to me. You're just doing things because it's how you do it, and you're not changing.
Well, and in fairness to Wisconsin, I believe their two starting liberos are injured. So they've had some injury trouble. I mean, something I thought about is Orzel played libero. Why not move her? Clearly your issue is passing and ball control. Move her back to libero. That will alleviate some of the pressure on Sarah Franklin. It will allow her to focus on being able to attack. You can't tell me one of the other 6 foot something flying athletes you have on the bench can't go in and score some points for you. I mean, if you have Orzel and Sarah Franklin passing in the back row, that other passer needs to pass a sliver. Pass the balls at you, go hit, get some experience. This just isn't working, and I'm shocked that there wasn't at least something different tried, especially after you didn't really play that well against Minnesota either.
You have a massive roster. Let's do some problem solving and find a way to make it happen, because this, like, DS, like, turnstile we have going on here, it's not working. I understand Lola Schumacher's out with a concussion. I understand that Gutschkin is also injured in some capacity, but, like, the core of your team is healthy. And it's not like, I'm sorry, it's not like Sarah Franklin is injured. It's not like we're talking about your main scorer is out. No, a libero and a DS. And quite frankly, in last few weeks, we have said that we don't think Lola Schumacher is it either. So, yeah.
Well, you have great middles on that team. Carter Booth could be an absolute weapon for you. And actually, I thought she was their best player against Nebraska, going 545 on 11 swings. But you don't pass particularly well, so you can't get her the ball. And you have a first-year setter who is playing in big matches, figuring out how to be an NCAA athlete in the Big Ten on the biggest stage. Help the girl out. They pass so many balls at the attack line. You need to shore up your passing so that Furbringer has the chance to actually run an offense. Get the middles involved, and then you might have a chance. But until you do that, you're going to lose to good teams, period.
Well, CeCe Crawford barely got set at all.
Five sets.
You have a middle that's hitting 545 or whatever you just said. And I'm sorry, but there were more opportunities to set her than she did.
Fair.
I thought Carter Booth was great. Feed her more. Feed CeCe Crawford more, 100%.
Well, Devin Robinson went zero on 12 swings, 3 kills, 3 errors. So you have to get Crawford involved in the game.
I do think watching that Furbringer was setting the pins too tight. There were a lot of sets that were trailing towards the net that she completely trapped her outsides. And I'm hearing the announcers being like, they need to be aggressive. They need to be aggressive. They couldn't. They could not be aggressive. When a set is trailing towards the net into the blocker's hands, it is stupidity to be aggressive and to try to take a big swing on that. They were just trying to keep the ball in play.
This is an observation that has no factual basis to it, but I think Sarah Franklin is really struggling to hit Furbringer sets. I think she is not finding a rhythm. I think there's a lack of trust of knowing where that ball is going to be. It's better out of the back row, but in the front row, she looks tentative. She looks like she's slowing down her approach to try and find the ball and see where it's going, and it's affecting her ability to attack. And like I said, it's not just Charlie setting because the passing's not great, but she looks hesitant.
I understand what you're saying. Part of me is wondering if maybe she's tired and exhausted. Honestly, I think in the last few matches, Sarah Franklin is looking like a way worse player than she actually is. I think she's very good. I think she's being put in positions that are difficult to score. I think, yeah, I'm not saying that the trust thing and the uncertainty is not a factor. I think it definitely could be. But I think she has been put in this position with Wisconsin that she is expected to do everything.
Well, that I agree with. You're poaching passes from the libero so that you can run your offense. You're expected to do that. You're expected to make digs. Nobody, if you think about having Orzel behind you as a libero, you just have so much more confidence because she's a great ball control player most of the time.
Like, you're asking so much of her. Like, not only is it like, hey, make sure to pass two-thirds of the court because our libero is getting aced off the court, but like, then get up and be ready to hit this back row ball, because I'm sorry, if and when Charlie Furbringer was setting somebody else, as soon as they didn't score, the next ball immediately went to Franklin. You need to repeat hitters. If somebody makes a mistake, you need to go back to them. You can't just panic and then immediately be like, oh, the next one has to go to Sarah. And I don't know if that is like messaging from the coaching staff, like, you need to get Sarah the ball if we don't score, or if that's her and Sarah's like a security choice for her, which, like, yeah, she should be, absolutely. But like, the weight of all the things Sarah Franklin has to do right now, I can see it.
And I would also say that pattern of going to Sarah after an error, good coaches will pick up on that, and she'll have a double, triple block on the next one.
Yeah, you're setting her up to fail right now. You know, we've talked about Carter Booth's performance, Cece Crawford not getting set enough, Orzel and her, you know, back row ball control strengths. Franklin, I think, you know, the one person we haven't really mentioned is Anna Smrek.
I think that if you look at her statistics over the season, her hitting numbers are impressive. However, if you break those down into when she plays against really good blocking teams that are sizable, 6'3", 6'4", 6'5", those numbers change drastically.
Or teams that have a solid game plan.
Fair. She likes to hit that deep seam, which is generally very effective to her, over top of the block with a lot of pace, into the back corner. When that shot is not available to her because it's going off the top of the block and they're getting recycled touches, she's not as comfortable going down the line or swinging sharp angle to make the block move. She just tries to go harder and higher, and it's not working for her.
Well, we said this last time Nebraska and Wisconsin played, in that it was very obvious that Sarah Franklin is the only person who can hit out-of-system balls. Anna Smrek is not an out-of-system hitter. She goes in at one speed. She needs a very specific set.
And you can talk about the setting, but the reality of it is, Furbringer's a freshman, and as a senior hitter, you need to bail that setter out sometimes. In the past, she's had experienced setters putting the ball in a very good place to allow her to be successful. And now that you're a senior, it's your job to do the same thing for your freshman setter. The ball's not always going to be perfect, but you need to find a way to be better than you currently are if you want the team to have success.
I would argue not even as a senior, but as a good opposite hitter. All over the world, the best opposites are the ones that get set the out-of-system balls. When the team's in trouble, they throw them the ball, and that hitter has to clean up the mess. You can't do that with Anna Smrek. She doesn't vary her attack enough, and for whatever reason, doesn't hit well enough angles to be able to be effective. So is this overly critical? I'm sure I'm going to hear some comments about it, but especially with their passing issues that you're seeing now, it's tough.
If we flip sides of the court and look at Nebraska, it was a really good team effort. They moved the ball around incredibly effectively. Nobody got that many more sets than anybody else. They passed well. They executed their defensive strategy. They put service pressure on. It was a classic execution of a team game plan.
I mean, as confused as I was watching Wisconsin's side, it was very clear what Nebraska set out to do. And to be able to see the execution of that plan was great. You know, I think from an offensive perspective, when Anna Smrek was in the front row, it was very clear they were not setting the left side unless they were out of system. They were forcing the middle and right side when Smrek was in the front row. As soon as Furbringer got to the front row, they started pumping the balls out to the left side. And it was effective. From a serving standpoint, they were testing Sage Damrow early. They got a lot of points, a lot of bad passes off of her. But then as soon as she would nail a perfect pass, they would switch it up and go somewhere else. They did not allow the libero to get into a rhythm.
Meanwhile, they were in rhythm almost the entire match.
I mean, there were times early, I think in set one, you know, we saw Riley running around a little more than usual.
Well, Nebraska was up 20-16, and then it was 21-19, and that was on the back of some passing and setting trouble.
Yeah, they had a little run there where things weren't as clean as usual, and I think also in that run, once when Bergen Riley was forced to run around, I think her sets got a little inconsistent. She was pulling the ball off the net for both pins. But I think the big difference between the two is that, like, Nebraska never disappears. You don't have stretches where the whole team is just gone. Like, nobody's perfect. Everybody makes errors, but it happens to maybe one person and the rest of the team is there to cover their back. Wisconsin, on the other hand, everybody would disappear sporadically.
You see Wisconsin try and get Andy Jackson out of rhythm, and she doesn't play particularly well. But you see Rebecca Alec step up and go 10 for 12, and she holds the middle. Even neutralizing one of their most dynamic players, somebody else steps up and you have other options.
I mean, I was critical of Rebecca Alec when we started this podcast about, you know, her lack of connection with Bergen Riley and mishitting a lot of balls. And I would say for the first half of the season, that was the case. I have to give her credit, and it is very clear that Nebraska has been working on that connection between Alec and Bergen Riley, and Alec is a much bigger offensive threat now than she was earlier in the season. She's making really good contact. She's hitting good angles. The opposing middle blockers need to respect her now because she's putting pace on the ball, and it's very hard to dig. So I have to give her credit and the Nebraska team credit for making that change. Another thing that has kind of developed is earlier in the season, Beeson was being taken out for serving. She wasn't staying in all the time. Nebraska has a back row option at all times now. When Beeson rotates to the back row, she's back there with the libero and a DS, so she is serving, and in that serve-receive rotation, she's hitting back row. Harper Murray then enters the back row, and Beeson is taken out, and Harper Murray is hitting from the back row. Nebraska has made sure, not only in their set distribution to be balanced, but in their available options to be balanced as well. So I can see the evolution of Nebraska over the last couple months and the things that they have implemented and improved upon and changed, and I can tell what they've been focusing on. I can't say the same for Wisconsin.
I think that's a fair summary of that match and the season so far.
I honestly think, based on all of the volleyball that we've been watching, seeing the ebbs and flows, the positive and the negative moments, the momentum, etc., Nebraska and Pitt are on a collision course. I just don't think that there are any teams out there that are as good as those two.
Both of them are complete teams with dynamic offenses where everybody is contributing. That is going to be a fun match if we get there. My one last question for you is, if we see a Wisconsin-Penn State quarterfinal, where's your money?
It's all going to come down to Wisconsin's passing. I think if Wisconsin can pass, they will win. I mean, just throwing it out there, I'll say Wisconsin.
I would say Wisconsin in five.
This was not the match that I was hoping it would be. I was hoping that we would have seen Wisconsin make some improvements from the last matchup. But it was, you know, nice to see Nebraska playing well. Like, do they have, like you said, they don't have any player that's, like, standing out and just being shining above the rest. The set distribution is even. The hitting numbers are respectable. Nothing crazy. They're a well-oiled machine. They know what their responsibilities are, and they execute. And honestly, that's all you can ask. It has been a big week, a passionate week, clearly, if the last segment was any indication of how I feel. But I think we're going to have an even bigger week this coming week.
I'm going to sit on the couch all day Wednesday, getting ready to eat a really big meal on Thursday. But on Wednesday, we'll be watching the following matches. You've got Pitt-Louisville, potentially for first place in the conference. You've got Stanford and Georgia Tech, who is fighting for their tournament spot. You've got SMU and Florida State. You've got Oregon and Purdue, BYU and Kansas, and Kentucky and Missouri. I mean, buy another TV, set it up, watch five volleyball matches. It's going to be a great day.
Just hunker down. Don't make any plans for Wednesday because you already know what you're going to be doing. On Friday, Penn State is hosting Nebraska, which, as we mentioned before, will likely be the key match to determine the Big Ten champion. And on Saturday, be sure to check out the ACC matches of Louisville versus Stanford and Pitt versus Georgia Tech. That concludes this week's episode of Volley Talk. There's always something shaking in the volleyball world, and we hope you enjoyed this little fix. Be sure to follow the show so you don't miss any updates, and we'd be so grateful if you'd leave us a 5-star review. You can also find us on Instagram at volleytalk_podcast. If you have a topic that you want us to discuss, be sure to let us know by reaching out to us on Instagram or at info@sarahpavin.com. Thanks so much for joining us, and we'll be back next week.